So last Sunday we talked just a little bit before we got into our Romans 15 study about Palm Sunday, what it was about and what why was that significant and so forth. But when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, he went in primarily to celebrate Passover with his disciples, and it was time for the Passover. So all the Jews were going up to Jerusalem. Now, obviously, Passover is one of the biggest holidays for Jews at that time and even in our present day. Especially, the significance of Passover at that time was that here was Jesus, who will be the Passover lamb offered for the sacrifice of mankind. And Passover was to be celebrated on Nisan 14th, which is the beginning of the year for the Jews. And Passover was to be celebrated for one day. That was a one day kind of a celebration for them. Jesus would, ride in just before the Passover, spend time in Jerusalem. He would be teaching there in Jerusalem. He would even cleanse the temple in Jerusalem. And then he would send his disciples to prepare a Passover meal. Now, following the Passover was the Feast of Unleavened Bread that starts right after Nisan 15th. And that feast lasts 7 days. And the first day of that feast and the last day of that feast is the High Day, or as often is called as High Sabbath. So they will be treated same as Sabbaths in the week. So the first and the last day of Unleavened Bread will be that. Now, following the first day of Unleavened Bread, there will be the Feast of the First Fruits. So there will be a lot of celebration going on in that day. And obviously there's a lot of significance for all that as we look at this whole story, this whole event with Christ coming into Jerusalem, being offered as a sacrifice, and then rising from the dead. Now, so this is the background. The Nisan 14th is the Passover. So in the evening, Jesus would be eating a meal with his disciples. So that would be what we will start reading right after this. The communion time that Jesus will have with his disciples will be happening around this time. On the following day, will still be for the Jews in the daytime, Nisan 14, because their day starts in the evening and lasts till the nightfall the following day. Not like us, we go 24-hour period and midnight starts the new day. For them, it's a little bit different. Now, on that following day, that will be the day that we will see Jesus to be crucified. That's the day when he is crucified. The following evening, so Nisan 15th in the evening, is when Jesus would be already in the tomb. And so the following 2 days would be Sabbaths. So Friday and Saturday will be Sabbath. The Friday would be the high Sabbath, and the next Saturday would be the regular Sabbath. And the Nisan 17th would be the day when Jesus would rise from the dead. Now, why is this important? Because it lays the foundation. So Jesus is crucified on Thursday. Now, we celebrate it on Friday because early church, sometime in the period of early church, somebody reading the scriptures saw the passage that we will read, that after Jesus' burial would be a Sabbath, and they assumed, well, probably he was crucified on Friday. And the only reason they assumed that, because they never considered the whole Feast of Unleavened Bread, that the first and the seventh day of that feast is the High Day. And you can read that in Leviticus 23, when these feasts are laid out: Passover, Unleavened Bread, and the First Fruits. So this is the background. This is what's going on. So let's go into communion time, which in Luke 22 we read, starting in verse 14, that Jesus got with his disciples. They sat down to eat the meal. And Jesus in verse 15 says this to them: "With a fervent desire, I have a desire to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Now, what's interesting about this is, again, what was the Passover about? The Passover is about the deliverance of the Jews from Egypt, how they were slaves in Egypt, and God sent Moses to deliver them. And in the process of them being delivered, God sent 10 plagues to Egypt. The final plague was the plague of the angel of death. All the firstborn will be killed by this angel. And the only way to avoid losing a firstborn is that on the doorposts, they were to put what? Blood. Blood of the lamb on the doorpost. So when the angel of death was passing by, he would see the blood or the covering over the home, and he will pass by, therefore the Passover. Now it's interesting that Jesus wanted to spend his last meal with his disciples celebrating this event. Why? Because this will be, in reality, the last Passover needed to be celebrated. Because from this point on, God's only Son will offer himself on the cross. And Jesus also knew what he was about to happen. He also understood what he is going to go through. Now, when we think about Jesus, and we understand he obviously was God, and he was fully God, fully man. But what's significant in this is that he spent 3.5 years with these guys. He lived with them, he slept in the same locations with them, shared a lot of things with them. They were, you know, the closest friends as they could be with somebody. And Jesus is sitting down to have this meal with them, knowing what's going to transpire. Knowing that when his darkest hour arrives, none of them will be there for him. Yet, he will be doing all that for them. He fully understood everything that's going to transpire. And now his heart is pouring on. He said, with a fervent desire, I waited for this. I really wanted to spend this time with you. And then obviously, as he does, he takes, you know, the bread and he says, this is my body which is given for you. In verse 19, do this in remembrance of me. Likewise, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. Now, put yourself in the shoes of the disciples. Not even a week ago, they entered Jerusalem triumphantly, with songs of praise and exaltation, everybody saying, here's the Messiah, here he comes, he let him be exalted on high. And they had this great expectation. They're going to rule and reign with Christ. And now he is telling them something that they did not expect to hear. Look, this is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you. This blood is establishing a new covenant. From this point on, God is going to write a new covenant between mankind and himself. The old covenant was what? Written in the blood of the goats and animals. It was written between God and the Jewish nation. And it was a conditional covenant. If they did something, the blessings will follow. If they did not obey God's law, the curses will follow. And where did that lead them? Well, not anywhere in reality. Yes, they kept the law at times, and they at times did not keep the law. And what happened is that as they were doing that, they walked away from the Lord continually. They will be walking away from the Lord because they were unable to keep the law, as we talked about it in Romans. And God knew that there was a need for a new covenant. That's why Jesus came, for this new covenant. Because we obviously know we are all sinners. When Adam and Eve first sinned in the Garden of Eden, the separation happened. Man was eternally separated from God. Adam and Eve couldn't no longer be in the presence of God. They had to be chased out. A sin brought this division. And the law of Moses could not tear down the division. There was a need for a new sacrifice, a new Passover lamb. they will actually tear down the wall of separation and erase the problem of sin and allow us to come into the presence of God. So when Jesus sits down to eat this meal with his disciples, all this is going through his head, and these are his closest friends, people who in whom he invested his energy, his time, everything to teach them. He viewed them as close as probably anyone else could view anyone on this earth. Yet when he looked at them, he knew that they were going to betray him. Now how would you feel? Would you be able to sit down at the table and rejoice at the meal you're going to have with those who are going to betray you? In a sense, those who are going to deny you, walk away. We probably would have no strength in us to do that. Yet he had a desire to spend time with them because he understood their weakness. He understood their shortcomings as he does ours. Now, a little bit later in same chapter in 47, we see that Jesus is by this time moved away from this meal and they went into the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples to pray. And we know that at this time, as he was in the garden, he prayed to the Father and he asked if there's another way. And the answer came, no. And he said, not my will, but yours be done. And it was such an intense prayer that the sweats of blood were dropping down from him, that even angels came down to minister to him. It was an intense time for Jesus. And he asked his disciples, well, still stay here and pray with me. And they failed to do that. He visits them three times and they're sleeping every time. And he's like, you couldn't even wait for an hour? Now, I don't think those comments were any condescending comments. It was just a surprise. They failed to see the significance of the moment. They failed to recognize the significance of the moment, despite of all the things he previously said to them. So verse 47 we see, and while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? When those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Now, again, these guys were sleeping. They're tired. They could not even stay awake to pray. And all of a sudden the multitude comes to arrest Jesus and Judas. One of them is leading them. One of them that they spent their time with, that they didn't doubt was a betrayer, is coming, giving a kiss to Jesus and saying, this is he. And they're getting ready to arrest Jesus. And now they have two swords. And we know that it was Peter who was like, I'm ready for action. And the chaos happens. He cuts off the ear of a servant. Jesus heals the servant's ear and asks for the disciples to be released. And interestingly, they don't stay. They run away. At first, they show a desire to fight. And I think it's a result of being tired and not fully understanding what's going on. But when the reality sank in, they realized what was going on. And all of a sudden, their reliance wasn't on God. Their reliance wasn't on Jesus. They looked unto themselves and got afraid and ran. And there was Jesus standing alone, arrested, taken to be tried. In verse 56, we will read how Peter followed at a distance as Jesus was being arrested. And as this trial is happening in the evening, Peter is at a distance, staying warm near the fire of the enemy. And we see in 56 that a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. And after a little while, another saw him and said, you also are of them, But Peter said, "Man, I am not." Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, "Surely this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean." But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are saying." Immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And Peter was reminded the words that Jesus told him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." And he weeps bitterly, walks away, disappointed in himself, that he denied his Lord in front of the people. And he walks away disappointed. Now at the same time as Peter is walking away, we know that Judas, Jesus' betrayer, returns the money that he was given to betray Christ and walks away, recognizing that he has betrayed the innocent man. And you have two men walking away from Christ, devastated with what they did. One with betrayal, one with denial. And they will have different ends. One truly repentant, one just sorry. And there's a big difference. Yet at the same time, Christ is standing by himself in front of his enemies. We see in verse 63, "Now when the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him, and having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, 'Prophesy, who is the one who struck you?' And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him." Notice mocking that happens and beatings. The insults were not just with the words, it was with their hands. Now, it's one thing to be hit. It's another thing to be hit blindfolded. Because our body is designed to resist the blow of anything coming to us with our eyes. So even in the worst case scenario, something comes at you suddenly, you still are able to do something about it. But when you're blindfolded, you don't know anything. And then the blows are harder, more intense. This is mankind at its worst. Just pouring out their anger at an innocent person. Hitting as hard as they could. Inflicting pain as hard as it's possible to inflict. In Acts 66, we see, as soon as it was day, so this was right in the morning time after that evening, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into the council, saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." They arrested Jesus, and what were some of the accusations that they had against Jesus? Well, one of them, that he was the Son of God. That was one of the accusations. But another big problem that we see in John's Gospel is because he did miracles on Sabbath. That was another problem. They felt that he was undermining their authority. Now, they already beat him up without a trial, without even establishing the case that he is truly guilty. And now they're asking, "Well, if you are the Christ, tell us." And he tells them, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe." And how true that is. Jesus knew their hearts. In their hearts, they made a decision. "We're going to get rid of you. We don't believe you. We don't believe in you. We want to get rid of you." Yet, because of the intensity of situation and the popularity of Christ, the people came into Jerusalem accepting him as the Messiah, they knew that they couldn't just stone him. They knew just they couldn't get rid of him. So they have to come up with a scheme, and the scheme is, we'll send him to Pilate. Let Pilate do our dirty work. So in the following chapter, in verse 1, we see, then verse, a whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Notice how twisted their words are. This is not what they They were accusing him, but this is what they want to accuse him now before Pilate. Now these are all lies. We all know that. Jesus never forbade to pay taxes, and Pilate knew that. Neither did he pervert the nation, and Pilate knew that. But yes, he was a Christ, and he was a king. And for Romans, that would be a problem. That would be an accusation that the Romans had to deal with. To have somebody come up and say, I'm a king that was not authorized by Caesar to be a king over a region, it would be a rebellion against the Roman Empire. So their hope is that Pilate will kill him because Jesus is king. As Pilate is investigating Jesus, he realizes he's from Galilee. Herod's here. Let's send him to Herod. I don't want to deal with this. Jesus now appears before Herod because he was in Jerusalem at that time. Verse 8. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracles done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. Notice the difference. Pilate is kind of not thrilled to have to deal with Jesus. Herod, on the other hand, is, but for a wrong reason. He wants to see a show. He wants to see a circus. He wants to see a performance. Because that's how he views Jesus. That's all that he is for him. And Jesus gives Herod not a single answer. It's interesting, when Jesus addressed Herod, was earlier in the Gospels, he sent a message, says, tell that fox. One of the few people in the scriptures that Jesus did not address in a nice way. That tells you a lot about Herod and what kind of a person he was. And the line of Herod was really, as we know in the scriptures, really weird. But Herod disappointedly sends Jesus back to Pilate because he didn't get his show. He didn't get his performance. And Jesus is sent back to Pilate. And Pilate obviously doesn't want to deal with this. He knows that Jesus is innocent. So he wants to do something. Maybe to find a way to release Jesus. And he makes the statement to the Jews in verse 14. I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse me. No, neither did Herod. And he's making it clear to them, he is innocent. I do not want him to be crucified. Verse 18, they all cried out in one, saying, away with this man and release to us Barabbas. And then we are given a comment by Luke, who has been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. Their cry is, give us a murderer and kill an innocent man. This was their cry. Now, we know from other Gospels that reason why this transpired, because Pilate had a custom at Passover to release a prisoner on their request. And it happened to be Barabbas was arrested about the same time. And Pilate probably assumed, well, they're never going to select this guy who is a murderer. He goes against their law. Yet, I think to his surprise, they asked for a murderer. And in that sense, Barabbas becomes the first person to benefit from what's going to happen to Christ. He is the first person to benefit from Christ's death. Verse 25, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. Notice this, twice mentions who was Barabbas. He was a murderer and rebellious person. And said they wanted to get rid of Jesus, and they got their wish. Verse 26, now as they led him away, speaking of Jesus, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus. I find it fascinating. This is the only time that we see Jesus needing help. By this point, we know that Jesus has been whipped by 39 lashes. We know that he was beaten prior to that. The crown of thorns was shoved into his skull. He is beaten beyond recognition. If you've ever seen The Passion of Christ, that's probably how it looked like. Most people, with all that happening to them, would not survive it. I mean, often people would die on those whipping posts when they will release those lashes on them. Someone would just die from the sheer pain. Yet Christ did not just on his body bear the pain of beatings, mocking, spitting, thorns, and whips. It was the pain of sin that he was carrying to the cross. And it was so heavy that he could not even walk to it. It was your and my sin that put him down, and he needed help to be carried to that cross. Verse 33, and when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. It's interesting that in the midst of his pain, weakness, suffering, he is still concerned about the people. Those people who caused this pain, who inflicted this pain, he is still concerned. And he is crucified as criminals were crucified back then. And he was put around the criminals, obviously fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah 53. Look in verse 35 where it says the rulers, there were people around who were making fun of him. And it says, verse 35, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, he saved others, let him save himself if he is the Christ, the chosen of God. And then 36, the soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. He is surrounded by mockers even in his death. Even in his the worst pain he could ever imagine, there are people mocking him. And we may look and think, man, these guys are disgusting. And we should. But we shouldn't be surprised. That's sin working in the lives of men. That's human heart in rebellion against God. And it's funny in this statement how misleading they were about their own belief. They said, well, if you're the Christ, take yourself from the cross. Save yourself. Because he was Christ, he couldn't do that. Otherwise, he wouldn't be the Christ. Because Christ was sent to suffer and die. Could he take himself off the cross? In an instant. As he said, there was legions of angels ready to come down and destroy every one of them. And I guarantee, at this moment, as Jesus is being mocked, I wouldn't be surprised that the legions of angels were just getting ready to get their swords out and just destroy every human being in Jerusalem if they had to. And they were probably shocked that the Father said nothing. No order was given out. Go and defend him. Because we are told in the scriptures that even angels did not understand the plan of salvation. Imagine the intensity of this scene. On earth, the Son of God being mocked, spit upon, crucified, beaten beyond recognition. In the darkness of mankind ruling, and then in a heavenly realm, angels ready to fight and are not given order to go. I cannot even imagine how Father felt looking down on his son and everything that was going on. If you have ever been in a situation that somebody looked at you with hateful look, said something in anger, your natural reaction would be just to, how do you dare? And imagine that in the scenario of your children doing that to you. It breaks your heart. You want to do something about it. You want to prevent them from showing such disrespect. Yet, mankind, God's children, looked at God and said, we don't want you. We want you to burn. We want you to go away. We want to bury you. And yet he was still willing to say, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do. And Father looks down and in agreement says, amen. They don't know what they do. Verse 39, we see then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him. Notice this word, blasphemed him, saying, if you're the Christ, save yourself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And I can, we're told in another gospel that at the first, both of them were mocking. They were part of this mocking scene, this ridicule. Yet there had to be something as he observed Christ and heard these words and comments that Jesus would made in between that made this thief look and reevaluate what's going on. And in the last ditch of hope that he ever had in his life, he hears his friend mocking and says, don't. We deserve this. He doesn't. And then he turns to Christ and says, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. I'm sure this was the only thing he could think of. He saw the sign above him that said, Jesus, you know, this is the King of the Jews. And maybe things he heard about Messiah, things that he heard from the scriptures, that he probably was disobedient his whole life as an adult, came flooding back to him and looking at him with the last hope he has, just please remember me. And I love these words. 43, Jesus says to him, assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. I mean, if there was ever the most comforting words you can give to somebody on their dying bed, this would be it. Jesus himself saying to somebody who never thought that they would receive mercy and grace from God is now being told, you will be in paradise with me. Then 44 we see, now it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. So for 3 hours, this crucifixion scene is transpiring. This mocking is going on. Mostly people who are there to see him go away, and those who are, few those are who are his followers, mostly the women with John. And then you have a first person to enter the heaven with Christ because of Jesus' death. Now what's interesting, before we get into the whole death of Christ, we know that Jesus will die before this thief. That the Romans will come after Jesus died and they will break the legs of these thieves so they will not be able to breathe and eventually they will suffocate and die after. And I find it fascinating, the grace of God working even in the dying of Christ for this man that was next to him on the cross. If he was to die prior to Christ dying, he wouldn't benefit from it. But God kept him alive so that he would benefit and be the first one to enter the heaven. And I find it fascinating. Here you have Romans, centurions, scribes, priests, the high priest, people of all sorts of walks of life, all sorts of regards. And you have this man who is of least regard being one of the first people to enter the heaven, a thief. Powerfully speaking of the grace of God that's being displayed and the love of God that's being displayed. Verse 45, then the sun was darkened and the veil in the temple was torn in two. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. And notice what it says in 47. So when the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, certainly this was a righteous man. How interesting. Two very unlikely candidates are responding to Christ. You have these learned men who mock him, and then you have a robber who goes, remember me. And then when Christ dies, and a centurion, a Roman, a pagan, looks at everything that transpired and says, this was a righteous man. And then notice what the scripture says. He glorified God. He was expressing faith. He was expressing something more than just he was righteous. He was perfect. He was Son of God. That's what he was saying. Then notice what happens after this. 48. And the whole crowd who came together to that sight, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned. As this whole scene unveils in kind of a storm and thunder and everything, and they observe it, they walk away and they realize, what did we just do? He was innocent. And they felt some form of remorse. They were carried away in their mocking with the mob. And now they were walking away, beating their breasts, thinking, what have we done? What have we done? Verse 50, now behold, there was a man named Joseph, a council member, a good and just man. He would be one of the Sanhedrin. One of the, we know him and Nicodemus were probably the two men in the whole leadership of the Jewish people who opposed to Jesus' death and crucifixion, who had not consented to their decision and deed. He was from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who himself was also waiting for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. That was a big step for a Jewish person, for a Jewish leader to go to Pilate. In the first place, to go to a Gentile's place on the holiday. Secondly, what he is about to do, he's going to ask for the body of man who was by the Jews described as a blasphemer. Then he's going to provide for this man a tomb. And it says, then he took it down, wrapped it in linen and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever lain before. Notice the progression. At first, everybody's against him. Walk away. And as they observe Christ in his suffering, in the trial, in how he carries himself, how he talks, how he deals with everybody in these times, people are changing. Those who mock look and say, man, he is innocent. Those who did not accept him are looking going, he is. He is the Son of God. Even Joseph and Matthias gets enough courage to actually step away from the council's desire and do something for Jesus. This was the moment that changed it all. This was the man who changed it all. He is the one who changed it all. He came for this purpose. Jesus said himself, "For this purpose I came to this earth. For this purpose, to die." Now we all know we are born and we will die one day. But we were not born to die. We are born to live for God, and then He will take us when He sees it fits. Christ was born for this purpose. His whole life was pointing to this hour, this moment, to achieve something that nobody at this moment expected would be achieved. Again, think of the angels ready to fight as they observe their Lord also, their God also, being crucified and dying. If there was ever a cry in heaven, that was the moment. But I guarantee the angels and everybody in heaven wept. And I guarantee the Father wasn't rejoicing. That was the hour why He was born. And why did He do that? For you. For me. He went through all that because He loves you. He loves me. He loves those who shoved the crown of thorns into His head. He loved that man who blindfolded Him and hit Him. He loved that man who spat on Him and challenged Him, "If you are the Son of God." He loved the high priest Caiaphas and Annas. He loved those who went before Pilate and lied so that they could have Him sentenced to death. He loved Judas, Peter, everyone. That was the hour when darkness was ruling. Yet, even when the darkness ruled, God was working the plan of salvation. Because nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. That's why we look, in a sense, back to this day, and it's called Good Friday. It should be probably called Good Thursday. And it's a good day. One of the worst days in mankind's history of what has been done, but what has been achieved, was very good. Salvation of mankind. Obviously, we know story does not end there. On Sunday, we will continue the story. We will continue. But at this moment, this is what we need to reflect on. This is the hour that Christ came for. He came for you and me. He endured all this for you and me. So we're going to have this time of communion now. And I'm going to pass the elements. And then I'm going to play a song. I'm not going to play it because I can't sing. It's called Outside the City. As the song is playing, I will encourage you on your own. This will be between you and the Lord Himself. Take the communion. You yourself, as the song is playing, take it. And then when the song is done, I'm just going to close in the final prayer and we will be done. So it won't be anything too special. But really, as the song is playing and you hear the words, reflect on just what we talked about. How much you're loved.